The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from Clark County Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, and Wright Memorial Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome back to the program today Ken Follett. He joins us on the telephone in the United Kingdom. Welcome back, Ken.
It's great to be back.
Ken, you have a new book out. It's called Never. And this is quite a story. Tell us how you got the idea for this.
Actually, the story of Never is set in the present day, but it's inspired by events of more than 100 years ago, the outbreak of the First World War, because when I studied that for The Fall of Giants, which is the first in my trilogy about the 20th century, I realized that no leader in Europe actually wanted a world war, but they all made decisions, quite sensible decisions, not crazy decisions. One by one, they all made decisions that led to what turned out to be the worst war the human race had experienced up to that point. And when I realized this, the question that then occurred to me was, could that happen again? In the present day, is it possible that we could stumble into a third world war, not because anybody wants it, but just because of a series of apparently sensible decisions that turned out to be disastrous? And then, of course, once I'd asked myself that question, came the question that is the beginning of all my novels, could I write a story about that?
And the story is truly the tale of a process of escalation. You have chapter titles that begin with DEFCON numbers. What is DEFCON? Some of our listeners probably don't know what that is.
It's the system the United States military uses for signaling the level of danger. And there are five stages. DEFCON is defense condition. And there are five stages. And number five is normal, no immediate danger. And then it goes up four, three. It was at three, if I remember rightly, it was at three during the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. Goes up to two, and it goes up. And one means nuclear war is imminent or has started. So that's the significance. And when I found out about this, I thought it was a very good way in the book to indicate the rising level of danger, because really that what drives the story in Never is this gradually, slowly increasing level of danger while everybody tries to prevent war. It becomes more and more likely as the book goes on, and DEFCON seemed to symbolize that very nicely.
Ken Follett joins us. His new novel is Never. And you just mentioned the Cuban Missile Crisis under John F. Kennedy. I don't think a lot of people realize just how close we got to nuclear war in that situation.
People forget, don't they? Or rather, the people who knew what it was like die off, and the young people who come along have no memory of it and don't realize. But certainly, my wife Barbara remembers during the Cuban Missile Crisis, going to bed and thinking, I may never wake up.
Oh.
And a lot of people felt that. It was a real head-to-head collision. And I think I wrote about it a bit in Edge of Eternity, which is the third book in my 20th century trilogy. I wrote about the Cuban Missile Crisis, a very dramatic moment. And I think it was the Kennedy brothers who saved the day. They set up what was called a back channel to the Kremlin, unofficial, a means by which the two sides could talk unofficially. And of course, Jack Kennedy made the decisions, but Bobby Kennedy actually made the connection with the Russians. And eventually, Khrushchev, who was leader of the Russian Soviets, leader of the Soviet Union at the time, eventually he backed down. But it had come terribly close. And people who were alive and adult at the time remember it was considerable fear and trembling. But I only just remember it because I was 13 at the time. And I didn't realize. But my wife Barbara is a little bit older than me, just old enough to understand that it could have been the end of the world.
60 years later, the balance of power has shifted somewhat. The Soviet Union no longer exists. In your new story, Never, the real powers are China and the United States. And you have a female president of the United States named Pauline Green. She's a Republican, and she's the one that has the power to use nuclear weapons. And you tell the story by switching to different theaters of action from North Africa to China, back to the United States. And we have all these characters that we meet. And I love the way you tell the story. Set this up for us.
Well, like the First World War, the story in Never starts with something relatively minor. First World War, the spark was an assassination in Sarajevo, assassination of a not very important person, the nephew of the Emperor of Austria. And in Never, an American soldier is killed by a terrorist in North Africa. And the terrorist is discovered to have used a Chinese rifle. And this sparks off a series of events. And the key thing about these kind of conflicts, these kind of rows in international diplomacy, is that there's a temptation for every leader involved to escalate, even if only slightly. If they have done something to us, and we're going to teach them a lesson by doing something worse to them. That's the thinking that causes escalation. Sometimes, of course, a leader will back off from a confrontation and will say, this is bad for us, but to escalate would be worse, and so we're going to suck it up. And, of course, no president or prime minister gets any thanks from the voters for that. They only really like it when the leader is strong and is tough and says, we will not put up with this because we are who we are and people can't push us around. And that kind of attitude, while very understandable, can actually lead to dire consequences.
You mentioned earlier that this is set during the current time, and all the leaders of these countries are fictional at this point, but everything that's preceded them is actual history. We hear references to Barack Obama, Ronald Reagan, and these leaders are obviously similar to certain people, but they're also very different. And Pauline, she has a critic, another politician with presidential ambitions, who is constantly on TV saying, we need to be tougher, we need to nuke them, we need to do this, we need to do that. So she's feeling all this pressure from this political rival to make decisions. And then we have this wild card, and the wild card is North Korea. And you really have fun with this.
Well, it's certainly a key element because it's a country, it's a desperately poor country. One of my advisors for this book said to me, North Korea only has one profitable business, and that is making and selling armaments all over the world. It's a farming country, but they can't produce enough food to feed their own people. So it's a country. It's a fragile country. There are many of those in the world, of course. There are many countries that are ruled incompetently and with populations who are, many of whom are destitute and starving. But certainly North Korea is one of them. And the key fact about North Korea is that it's officially, it is China's only military ally.
Mm-hmm.
So it is very closely linked with China, but not really friendly. They are like two people in a bad marriage. They're married, and they've got to stay married, but they really don't like one another. So that's how North Korea gets into the story by being a problem for China and a problem for the United States.
Oh, I think that's slightly amusing that you mentioned that North Korea and China are like a bad marriage, because we have a world leader in your story who also is dealing with a bad marriage. And I'm being really careful not to do any spoilers here and to not give away too much. Okay, Ken?
Yes. Well, it's important. You've put your finger on something that's very important, because all of these characters don't exist outside the story. That's to say, they must exist outside the story. So any major character, much of the things that he or she does and the scenes that he or she is involved in advance the story, but not all of them, because some of them are about that person's private life.
Mm.
And the issues in a person's private life may matter to them as much as the issues they're dealing with in their work. But they also, those issues also round out the character. And we mustn't forget that whatever the story, the object of the exercise is to get the reader to share the emotions of the people in the story.
Uh-huh.
And that's when we do that as readers, when we do that, when we become emotionally involved in a novel, that's when we really start enjoying it, isn't it?
Uh-huh.
We start to hope that things are going to turn out for some of the characters. And we start to hate some of the characters. And then we start to be indignant if the people we like are badly treated and that kind of thing. These are all emotional reactions. They're reactions, of course, to a story that the reader knows never actually happened. It was made up by Follett sitting in his library in Stevenage in the UK.
Uh-huh.
And staring at a screen and dreaming stuff up. But nevertheless, we all of us who love novels, and I'm one of those, all novelists, I think, begin by loving to read novels. And despite the fact that we know this is made up, we still have emotional reactions, almost as if we're looking at something that's really happening.
Mm. Ken Follett has joined me on the program this morning. We're talking about his new novel, Never, which just came out this week in the U.S., and I'll continue my conversation with him right after this. It's the Book Nook. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, making radio with the community and for the community. And my pleasure today to be speaking again with Ken Follett. His new novel is Never. He joins us on the telephone in England. And Ken, my favorite character, you have a lot of characters I really love, but the one that really stood out to me is this young man who is the Chinese spy, whose father is an influential bureaucrat. I love this character.
Well, thank you. I'm very glad you do. I'm quite fond of him, too. Chiang Kai is his name, and he's the head of the Foreign Intelligence Division of the Chinese Secret Service, and he's also married to a very beautiful star, Chinese movie star. So the two of them are, in some ways, a real power couple. He is a moderate. He spends most of the book trying to prevent war and warning people that some of the decisions that they're making may cause a war. His father is opposed to him. His father is an old hardline communist who says, we won the revolution and we must keep hold of all the gains we made, all the changes we've made in society are wonderful, forgetting, of course, the terrible famine in which millions died in the Mao era, forgetting that, of course, that's never mentioned by Chinese government people today. So the conflict, the political conflict within the Chinese government between the progressives and the hardliners is also a conflict within Cai's family.
Mm.
And his enemies try to get at him through his wife also. So once again, the person is a key player in the plot, but he also has a rich and complex life outside the plot.
He really does. Another favorite is Abdul, but we'll let readers discover these characters. My guest is Ken Follett, and his new one is Never. I frequently hear it said that all these wars throughout our history were instigated mostly by men. Men made the decisions. Men created the situations where violence occurred and millions of people died. And in your new book, it's very modern. We have two leaders who make decisions that impact millions of lives, and they're both women, the president of the United States and the president of South Korea. I found this intriguing.
Well, my mother would certainly have agreed with you. She used to say that if women ran everything, there would be no wars. And there's something in that, although I think Margaret Thatcher actually proved my mother wrong, because she started a war in the Falkland Islands.
Yeah.
But that aside, I do actually think. I think there was some truth in what my mother said. And the reason Pauline Green is, the reason that I've made the President of the United States a woman is that I wanted to underline the fact that she does not want a war. She's a peacemaker. She's not bellicose. And I do think, we have to be terribly wary, don't we, of saying, talking about how the two sexes are different, the two genders are different, but I think there's some truth in it. Generally speaking, women are less likely to start fights, aren't they, than men? You very rarely see two women punching each other in a pub, but it's not that unusual to see two men getting into some kind of a scuffle when they've had a few drinks. And so I think there is, and of course, it's not the case that all men are the same and all women are the same. There are aggressive women and there are peacemaking men. But overall, I think we do see that women are a bit less likely to start a fight, either in a pub or in the White House. And men are more likely to go to war and to start thumping each other when they've had a few drinks. So, it's a simple thing, but I think it's true.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is, of course, that powerful women are a reflection of what our world is like today. And 50 years ago, it wasn't so. And when I wrote Eye of the Needle, I was the first author to make a woman the hero of an outdoor adventure thriller. And it's at the end of Eye of the Needle, really the second half of Eye of the Needle is about a battle between two people on a lonely island. One of the people is a very dangerous spy. And originally I thought of it as a battle between two men. And then I realized early on that it would be so much more interesting if the other person in the battle was a woman. And even better, a woman carrying a 4-year-old child on her hip.
Uh-huh.
It made the whole contest, and especially the final physical fight, made the whole thing so much more interesting. And it was, in those days, it was unusual. 10 years later, we had The Silence of the Lambs, in which the FBI agent was a woman, played by Jodie Foster in the movie.
Uh-huh.
After Eye of the Needle and The Silence of the Lambs, it began to become much more common for women to be heroes in thrillers. And then nowadays, you wouldn't think it was particularly unusual. And I think it's just, it's mainly a reflection of the way the world has changed. It's no longer the case that women are, all women are expected, you know, 50 years ago, all women were expected to play minor roles. There was, you know, to be obedient and be assistants to people and secretaries and all that kind of thing. And nowadays, women expect to have at least a chance of getting the boss's job. Mm-hmm. And quite rightly. But I grew up with that. That was normal for my generation. And so, you know, it's normal in life, and so it's normal in my books.
As we escalate through your novel, Never, through the DEFCON alerts, we get a lot of analysis of this country has this many nuclear weapons, this country has this many, if they have to go against each other, this is going to happen. And as we read the news, there's no way we can keep a story consistent with what's happening, breaking news. Just in the last couple of weeks, I saw something where the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the United States observed that we had just seen a Sputnik moment and that the Chinese had developed technology for missiles where we could no longer defend ourselves against this particular technology. We could not shoot those missiles out of the sky. There's a lot of that kind of action going on in your story. When you cited these numbers, were these fairly accurate at the time as far as the number of warheads, or was that fictional?
No, not at all. No, I gave the correct number of missiles and warheads for every country, and it gets a bit blurry because there are two numbers. There's the number of warheads, the total number, and then there's the number that are ready to be fired. And so, for example, the United States, now I'm not going to remember exact numbers now, but the United States has 3,000 and something nuclear missiles, and about half of them are ready to be fired, and the other half are in store. And you get that kind of, when people quote these numbers, you sometimes get that kind of confusion. But I had very knowledgeable advisors for this book. One of my advisors was a British general, a young chap, retired from the army now. He had all the fingers, all the figures at his fingertips. He hasn't been retired very long, and he had all the figures at his fingertips. So where I had gone wrong, where I had slightly misunderstood published figures, he was able to set me straight. So I'm pretty sure that all of that kind of information in Never is accurate. It's interesting what you say about the new Chinese missile, which is very, very fast and flies very low. And they said that it couldn't be detected and shot out of the sky by our anti-missile missiles. But, you know, our anti-missile missiles are in any case, not completely effective. And in any conceivable nuclear war where an enemy would throw huge numbers of missiles at us, and some of them are going to get through. You know, it's worth having these missile defenses, but they're nowhere near perfect. And so the new hypersonic missile that the Chinese have developed, yes, it is. But for us, of course, who are used to being in the lead, used to being in the lead technologically, it is a bit of a shock to be overtaken by one of our enemies. But it isn't, in fact, it doesn't really change the balance of power. The United States still has something like 10 times the number of missiles and nuclear warheads as the United States. 10 times the number. Mm-hmm. So the American military is still overwhelmingly strong. Whether, you know, how long that will continue is another question. But at the moment, the Chinese are making a lot of noise, and they're giving us some nasty shocks. But they're a long way from matching the strength of the United States.
And in your novel, the Chinese leader is fairly moderate. And you also state the fact that the last war the Chinese were in was way back in 1979 in Vietnam, and they really have not been in a war since then. We've certainly been in some wars in the United States, and I find this fascinating when we look at the arc of history to observe these kinds of things. Ken, I just want to talk to you a little bit about life in these last couple of years. The last time I had you on the show, it was at the heart of the pandemic, and you mentioned that one of the things that you really miss is playing music with your friends. Have you been able to do that since then?
Yes, we've relaxed slightly, and so we do see friends, and I do see them, and I play music with the band. We're still, Barbara and I at any rate, we're still not going to the theater or the cinema. We feel that that's too much of a risk to be seated, you know, in a so close in a room with, you know, maybe 100, 500 people, maybe more in a theater. We feel that that's too much of a risk, and so we're still not doing that. But we are seeing friends, and we are planning to spend Christmas in Southern California, where many of our family live.
We
haven't seen those children and grandchildren for 2 years, and so it'll be we're really looking forward to catching up with everybody. Our daughters, for different reasons, our daughters moved to Southern California. And they love living there, and we love visiting them, and we have been prevented from doing so for 2 years, but we're going to make up for it now that we're allowed to.
Well, that sounds wonderful. My guest is Ken Follett. His new novel is Never. He joins us on the telephone in England today. And Ken, you've had such extraordinary success as a writer. You've written so many books. You've had so many readers. You have so many readers. What keeps you going?
You know, it's the most interesting thing in my life, and I wake up in the morning, and what's on my mind is how I'm going to handle the next scene in the book I'm writing, and I can't wait to get to the keyboard and start doing it. It continues, even though I've been doing this for nearly 50 years, it continues to fascinate me, it continues to challenge me. It doesn't get easy, it doesn't get boring, and, you know, I just, I get such a kick out of it, and the idea of stopping is really quite horrendous to me. In fact, I sometimes say, you know, when I go to hell, they will make me play golf all day.
That does sound like hell. Whoa. Ken Follett is my guest. His book is Never. I have just enough time for one more question, Ken. What's the last book you read that just really blew you away?
Well, I'm really enjoying Cemetery Road by Greg Iles.
Oh, I love that
like
book.
Thrillers. Oh, good.
I had him on for that show, for that particular book. Yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Oh, great. Well, you know, I've occasionally exchanged emails with him, but I've never actually met him. But I've admired his work for a long time, and happily he likes mine. So so when eventually we do meet, it will be kind of a buddy fest.
And this is a man who survived the most horrendous accident. Are you familiar with what happened?
I don't know.
Oh, my. He was in a terrible, terrible auto accident, nearly died a few years ago, and just an amazing guy to come back from that.
Yeah.
Well, Ken, it's such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for your time.
You're most welcome. I enjoyed talking to you, and I'm sure we'll talk again.
Thanks, Ken. Take care.
Thank you, Vic.
My guest has been Ken Follett. His book is Never, just out on Viking. And you heard about it on the Book Nook on WYSO. And I interviewed Ken last year for his book, The Evening and the Morning. And you can go to our website at wyso.org and track down that interview and listen to the podcast at wyso.org. And the Book Nook will continue with a special bonus segment right after this. And what a pleasure it was to talk to Ken Follett again. about his latest novel. It's called Never. Ken has sold over 178 million copies of his books and doesn't seem like he's slowing down or having any intention of ever stopping. And that's a great thing to witness. An almost 50-year career writing best-selling novels. And we have a little extra time on the program today, and I was excited to hear that on Monday night, PBS stations are going to be airing a documentary film called Storm Lake. Some of you might recall that I've interviewed a guy named Art Cullen who had a book called Storm Lake, and Art is the publisher, or maybe they call him the editor, of the Storm Lake Times. That's the local paper in Storm Lake, Iowa. It comes out twice a week, and these little community newspapers are under threat these days. Many of them have been closing up. Iowa has more of them per capita than any other state. I believe there's over 300 of them in Iowa, or at least there were the last time I checked. And Art Cullen, amazingly, a few years ago, won the Pulitzer Prize for the newspaper with his editorial writing. I've interviewed him twice for his book Storm Lake when it came out in hardcover and again in paperback. And this documentary has been getting great reviews. It's going to be airing on PBS stations on Monday night. And I believe the time is 10 o'clock, but you'll need to check your local listings. Here is a plug I saw for it online. Dolores Cullen is scanning through photos she'd taken at a local elementary school where Abby Bean, the reigning Iowa pork producer's pork queen, had enthused over the finer points of hog production. The kids were encouraged to oink. There was a piglet wearing a diaper. It was the sort of event that oozes cute. But that's not what was on Cullen's mind. While driving through Albert City, she was hit with an odor so foul that she couldn't stop talking about it. It was so putrid, I almost gagged from hog confinement, she says, when she commented on the smell during a visit to the post office to deliver newspapers. She was told it was from corn that had been put out to dry. No, she says she responded. This is not the smell of drying corn. This is hog. Censored word. Welcome to the Storm Lake Times, a 21-year-old twice-weekly newspaper with a circulation of about 3,000 that covers Buena Vista County in Iowa. The paper is the subject of a documentary, Storm Lake, that will be broadcast on most PBS stations this coming Monday night, November 15th. The film by Jerry Rissius and Beth Levison tells the story of a small rural newspaper's fight for survival at a time when local papers across the country are cutting back and shutting down. At the center of that story was the Cullens, a remarkable family who persevered through calamities such as the rise of agribusiness, which wiped out much of the local advertising that had once sustained the paper, the spreading tentacles of the internet, which grabbed another big chunk, and finally, the insidious invasion of COVID-19. The Times is already among our better-known rural newspapers by virtue of a Pulitzer Prize that it won in 2017 for a series of editorials written by Art Cullen, the editor. As the Pulitzer judges put it, the paper successfully challenged powerful corporate agricultural interests in Iowa. Cullen's editorials so enraged those interests that the Iowa Senate refused to approve a resolution of congratulations, a tidbit that did not make it into the film. That film showing on your PBS stations this coming Monday night. Cullen later wrote a book about his life as a small-town newspaper man, but his notoriety appears not to have been of much help to the Times' bottom line. Indeed, Storm Lake is a story of struggle. At one point, the publisher, Art's older brother John, explains how he spent months listening to readers in order to pare the television listings down from 80 channels to 31 without sparking too much outrage, thus saving about $10,000. Art Cullen is the narrative center of the film, rail thin with a shock of unkempt white hair, less unkempt after he submitted to a haircut administered by Dolores, his wife. A bushy horseshoe mustache and wire-rimmed glasses, we see him interviewing a range of characters, from a farmer talking about how a surplus of rain has stunted the corn crop, to then-presidential candidate Elizabeth Warren on stage in front of hundreds during the run-up to the Iowa caucuses. We're treated to several samples of his lyrical writing as well. The caucuses provide a welcome break from the monotony of rural life. Democratic candidate Pete Buttigieg drops by, and he's not allowed to leave until he's autographed an enormous Storm Lake Times sign that adorns the newsroom. Art takes part in an MSNBC panel moderated by Chuck Todd. Art and his son report from the scene on caucus night, their disappointment palpable as it becomes clear that problems with the app used to tally results mean that there would be no results for quite some time. The Times headline, "Who won the caucuses? Not Iowa." "Everybody thinks this is going to kill the Iowa caucuses," Art says. "It shouldn't, but it will." A short time later, he adds, "It's not the process that broke down. It's the app. It's kind of too bad that we just can't be more patient with democracy." The COVID-19 pandemic followed the caucuses by just a few weeks, and it nearly put the Times out of business. Advertising was down 50% in March 2020. Art and John muse about walking away rather than piling up more debt or selling the Times building. But they prevailed. We learned at the end that the paper held a successful GoFundMe campaign, signed up more than 100 new subscribers, and unveiled a redesigned website that was attracting 1.2 million page views per month. The paper would survive. "The pay is lousy and the hours are terrible," says Art, "but you can change the world through journalism." Here's Art Cullen talking about his book, Storm Lake, and the film coming up on PBS Monday night on the Book Nook. You talk a lot about farming practices. You look at your lake there, a beautiful Storm Lake, and the history of that lake and how the farming practices have affected it, and how the big farming since the farm crisis in the 1980s has changed the topography there and has really impacted things. And then with climate change happening, you look at the dangers and also the hopefulness that maybe we can do something about it.
Yeah. What's happening is the reason we won the Pulitzer Prize, if I'm not getting ahead of myself here, is that it was over a series of editorials we wrote concerning a lawsuit that was filed by the Des Moines Water Works, which serves drinking water, 500,000 drinking water consumers in the Des Moines metro area. And they sued Buena Vista, Calhoun, and Sac counties here in northwest Iowa. Buena Vista, Storm Lake is the county seat of Buena Vista County. And they sued us over nitrate pollution of the Raccoon River because, you know, agriculture, fertilizer, it was placing nitrate and phosphorus in unsafe levels in the Raccoon River. So they sued over that, trying to regulate agriculture to stop polluting surface water in the United States. And we wrote a series of editorials on it, urging, first of all, transparency, because the counties, in their defense, were being funded by the agribusiness giants like Monsanto and the Koch brothers. And we demanded to know who the other donors to this fund were, so we could know who's actually writing judicial policy in Iowa. And it's not the taxpayers of Buena Vista, Sac, and Calhoun counties. It was the agricultural oligopoly that essentially owns Iowa. And we also were learning that climate change was delivering more extreme weather, which was causing exponentially higher soil erosion rates. And that plays into it as well. We're polluting the Gulf of Mexico with our soil. Some of the best soil in the world is now in the Gulf of Mexico, creating a dead zone the size of New Jersey and growing. So we're destroying the shrimping industry so we can grow 200 bushel per acre corn in Iowa and Illinois. And that's what this whole lawsuit was over. And that's what won us the Pulitzer Prize, was making the connections between agricultural practices, climate change through extreme weather, and how that's impacting the environment, you know, almost a continent away. And that's how we won the Pulitzer.
All right, so let me clarify this for our listeners. The Des Moines Water Works was having to treat the water in the Raccoon River where they get
Correct.
Their water for Des Moines, and they were having all these problems with all the runoff from agriculture further up the river in places like Storm Lake and your county. And so they
Right.
sued the counties, these three counties, and the defense against the suit was being paid for by these mysterious entities. Over $1 million in legal fees was going to these
Correct.
Law firms, and you were having a very difficult time finding out where the money was coming from.
Yeah, they said basically it's our county supervisors essentially told us it's none of your business who's paying for our defense. And we said, well, it is our business because there could be a huge liability on all the land in Buena Vista County if the Des Moines Water Works is successful. We deserve to know what who your lawyers are and who's paying them. And they wouldn't tell us, and so we had to engage with the Iowa Freedom of Information Council to write letters jawboning them and convincing them that donors to government operations are public records under the Iowa Public Records Law. And so the county eventually, after having spent, as you noted, $1.5 million defending itself in this federal lawsuit, eventually divorced itself from this secret slush fund. So we gained a Pyrrhic victory in that we got dark money out of the federal court system. But about 6 months after that, a federal district court judge ruled that the county couldn't be sued by the waterworks because there's really no way to remediate the damage. That is, you cannot regulate agriculture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so that's where we're at. You can't regulate agriculture, and that's why people in Toledo, Ohio, couldn't drink their water for a summer. And that's why the Chesapeake Bay is under administrative orders from the EPA. But nothing changes because agricultural practices haven't changed.
And they're the same way here in Ohio. I live right across the street from a field that is corn or soybeans, and we have the same monoculture going on, and we have the same protections for farmers who are allowed to let runoff go into lakes. I know someone who's a devoted listener to this station who complains constantly about all the algae growing in his lake and how he can't do anything about it, how the county extension people won't do anything, how the farmers can just get away with it.
Right. And that's been ensconced now in law, but, you know, we have a precedent in Iowa now that says, essentially, you cannot sue over the Clean Water Act and agriculture non-point source pollution under the Clean Water Act. So, in other words, there's no remedy.
Hmm.
Monsanto and the Koch brothers can fertilize and spray Roundup to their heart's content, and there's nothing anybody can do about it.
You also talk about the incentives that are created for farmers, because if they want to let their land be under the CRP, if they want to let it go back to prairie, they need to get some kind of compensation. And
yes.
Under this administration, it looks like that kind of compensation is rapidly vanishing.
It is. In fact, in the new farm bill that was just passed by a Republican Congress and signed by a Republican president, they are dismantling the Conservation Stewardship Program, which gives farmers money to use on working lands. That is, cattle producers who want to raise cattle sustainably on grass pasture. They and rotate crops and put in infield buffers. That program is being defunded. And so crop insurance can be funded. And what crop insurance does is it allows you to plant on a river bottom that's getting flooded out 3 years out of five, and you get paid for that soybean crop even if it's flooded out and all the soil's going down the Raccoon River. And I have photos of soybeans being planted in to the Raccoon River, into the banks, and into the lake banks. State-owned lakes are being farmed in Iowa.
Scary stuff. My guest is Art Cullen. His book is Storm Like, A Chronicle of Change, Resilience, and Hope from a Heartland Newspaper. And as I was reading it, you're such a name dropper. You mentioned so many people in here. You mentioned all these governors of Iowa. And I kept expecting you to mention one who I think he served one term as a Republican, and he's from your part of the woods, but you never mentioned him. Robert Blue from Eagle Grove. Why'd you leave him out?
Robert Blue, because he left no impression.
good answer. Good answer.
There were several colorful figures in Iowa history, probably the most colorful being Henry Wallace, a former vice president and secretary of agriculture, who tried to form a new progressive party and run as a progressive populist post-World War II.
1948, and the creator of what is Pioneer DuPont now.
Correct. What used to be called Pioneer Hybrid International. Henry Wallace learned at the hand of George Washington Carver about plant life and created hybrid corn, a stronger variety of corn that could flourish and increase yields and feed the world. And unwittingly, it led to this revolution in agriculture, this industrial revolution. This produce, we're now farming, using genetically modified corn, farming on a petrochemical base, and polluting everything around us. And in fact, compounding global warming, because nitrogen is every bit as serious of a greenhouse gas as carbon dioxide. And all the nitrogen that we apply to grow corn, we're losing about 30% of that in waste to the environment. And so those are huge climate impacts in and of themselves that are making the problem worse.
That was newspaper editor Art Cullen talking about his book Storm Lake. My first interview for that book, we did two of them. That was recorded in 2019. And the film Storm Lake will be running on PBS stations, a documentary about that community in northwest Iowa, on Monday night, and the time I saw was 10 p.m., but you might want to check your local listings just to make sure. I'm not sure it's the same time zone that I was reading about, so it could be earlier or later. You never know. But Art Cullen is an amazing guy, and I loved interviewing him, and I'm looking forward to seeing the film Storm Lake. It's been getting some excellent reviews. The Book Nook comes your way every Saturday morning at 7 and every Sunday morning at 10:30, and they are different programs. And tomorrow, my guest at 10:30 Sunday morning will be a guy who I consider to be our greatest literary humorist. Amazingly, he wasn't born in the U.S. He was born in what was then known as Leningrad, in what was then known as the Soviet Union. His name is Gary Steingart, and he's written what some critics are calling the first great pandemic novel. It's called Our Country Friends. It's set in upstate New York, and a group of friends are hunkering down during the year 2020, trying to avoid the pandemic. And Gary's comic wit is strewn throughout the pages of Our Country Friends. It's already a New York Times bestseller, and he's one of my favorite people to interview. The first time I talked to him was for his first book. He came out to Yellow Springs to see me, and I fell in love with his work. I've done many interviews with him since, and we'll do one more tomorrow morning at 10:30 in the Book Nook as Gary Steingart joins me again to talk about Our Country Friends. Right here on WYSO, where we have almost 800 podcasts available at wyso.org to listen to at your leisure for the Book Nook. I'm Vic McCunis.